Welcome back to Foreign Connect podcast. Today, we have a special guest from Boston, Bill. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Thank you very much. Glad to be on.
Yes. So to start off this question, to start off this interview, I wanted to ask you your background, what you do, like what you do in your current company. What is your background?
Certainly. So currently I'm a coach. And it's sort of a term of art. Coaching is got all sorts of definitions to it. But basically what I do is I help leadership teams to build a healthy and thriving organization. And I do that using a growth framework as my primary way of doing it. So mostly I'm a teacher of that. And prior to being a coach, which I've been for about a little over 4 years, I was a startup guy. I did startups for about 25 years. And I started in 1991, and I did 10 over that time, and I had a pretty good track record. I was about, depending on how you count my contribution after I left, I was either 5 for 10 or 5 for 7, so still pretty good either way. So I got lucky with a good bunch of people, and we had some good luck, and especially early on. So that's sort of my background.
I see. And having that being said, I know when we had the previous conversation, you mentioned that you took some startups making an IPO, right? Like you were there from the beginning to taking them into IPO. Like, can you tell me what did you learn from that process?
Sure. So this was a long time ago, and the going public process is different now than it was then. So this was in the mid 90s, early 2000s, during the dot-com boom, as it used to be called. So lots of companies went public when they never should have gone public. The two companies I was with, neither of them was over $10 million in revenue, and neither of them was profitable. And I don't really think that's true today. I think we've learned from that. Say, you know, you can't really go public until you've proven that you know how to run a business and that kind of thing. But these were crazy days. So there was one company that I went public with, and all we did is we tried to keep growing. That was our goal. And we were growing at a pretty good clip. There's a general rule of thumb that I don't know if it's still true, but it was when I was there, was that you know you're working pretty well as a startup when you grow your top line. I think it's triple, 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 double, double. So you'd grow three times growth, and then 2x, 2x. And then if you do that, then you're probably at a relatively good clip. But I will tell, I will to your listeners, I will say, if at all possible, at least in the U.S. markets, I don't know about the Nikkei or other markets. I wouldn't go public if I didn't have to. Because I think we're learning from, conscious capitalism and other really good businesses that the public market forces you to think in the really short term. And that's not really healthy. We're learning that you need to take the longer view, because if you take the shorter view, you'll make poorer decisions. So your decisions won't be as good because you're just trying to make the next quarter. And that's not how most businesses work. You know, I have my businesses that I work with as a coach. We plan out 3 years ahead, and we're looking to make decisions for the future. And if you look at the really good businesses that are out there, what they do is they're thinking longer term, and they're making decisions. Even though there's a lot of opinion on Amazon, but Jeff Bezos took the long view. You know, Amazon was not profitable for a long, long, long time. Because he said, I know what I'm doing. I know what I want to do. You know, I want to be the world's marketplace. And in order to do that, he had a number of steps he knew he had to take. First was prove it, which was with books. And then he started to sell other stuff. And, then he added affiliate marketing as another channel. He added all these things. And then he said, okay, now what I need to do is sell other people's stuff. So let me test that. And that was the third party things. And along the way, he's always trying to make it more efficient. What he says, it's some irrational obsession with the customer or something is his sort of mantra. And he wasn't profitable. And he said, actually, they're not super profitable right now. I think actually COVID has made them extremely profitable. You know, we've done 10 years of e-commerce in about 8 months.
Right.
So that's what I would say is sort of focus on that. Focus on making a really healthy company, and the growth will come if you do a few things well.
Mm, I see. And actually, Alberto here, our co-host, well, I would call it part-time co-host for now, is actually works in the financial sector, and he has a lot of insights around, you know, what makes company, like how investors and business owners should look at business in terms of like its worth. So I wanna loop you in this conversation. Do you have any following up question of what he says? Because one of the things that so go ahead first.
No, I think that Bill really touched on a very interesting point, which is the stress that, especially right now, there is on short-term goals, especially in America, particularly, you know, if you're a public company, probably if you're a middle market company, private company, family business, this is somehow different. But if you aspire to be public and you actually become public, you have a whole lot of pressure. And, you know, the question that probably I have for Bill on this one topic is, how can you strike a balance, right? Because sometimes
that was going to be my question too. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, you have this great project, right, that could be extremely profitable in the future, but it might take a while, right? It might take 3, 5, maybe even 6 years before you turn a profit. And at the same time, obviously, you have pressure, you have stakeholders and shareholders and capital lenders, you know, everybody pushing you, right? It's hard. And so oftentimes CEOs rush into decisions that are not so, you know, smart in the long term. So how can you work with these people, you coach them.
Right.
How can you possibly strike a balance there?
So my answer is, I don't think you can. I think what you have to do as a leader is say, here's my vision, right? If you want to invest in my company, you have to buy into this thing. I think it's going to take 10 or 15 years to get there. I think it's going to cost us much money. And if you're okay with that, then you should put this in because it's going to be huge, right? And I'm sure Jeff Bezos said eventually this is going to be, if I'm the world's marketplace and you look at the trillions of dollars that are spent every year in goods and services that they would potentially put out, I mean, it could be massive, even if they're a small percentage of it. So that's, I think, what you'd have to do. And I guess that's what he did because his investors, I mean, he didn't go public for a really long time, but his investors gave him time and they said, it's okay. And they kept giving him money. He kept getting money, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to build all this infrastructure because people believed what he was doing was right. So I don't think you can strike a balance. I think, you know, and hopefully, I know the Business Roundtable put out their newest sort of manifesto or whatever, which said, you know, you got to pay attention to all the stakeholders. It's not just the shareholders, which means that also lengthens the amount of time that it'll probably take. Because if you're thinking about not only your shareholders, but your employees and your customers and your suppliers and your partners, that's a lot of people to take care of. And that just takes time. So I think it's a great idea because I'd rather, Freud says there's only two things that we really need to do to be happy and to be fulfilled is to love and to work. And we spend a lot of our adult life at work. And especially now, you know, people are working 17 hours a day because you're home and that's the office too. But most people are really unhappy. And I think one of the reasons they're really unhappy is that of the impatience of the leadership to get to some goal, some arbitrary goal, and they're pushing everyone. And they're not asking for your opinion. They're just saying, hey, let's just go because it takes too long. You know, there's that African proverb, right? If you want to go far, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. We want to go far. And so you have to bring everybody with you. And that just takes a while. So I think that's, don't think you can do it. I don't think you can strike a balance.
That's a very, very interesting point. And actually, it's perfect that you just said it because that leads to me to my another question, which is to ask you, you know, why do few companies survive and then few flourish and most fail, right? Like this is one of the questions that I had for you. And I think from the previous answer you just mentioned about, you know, lack of patience in leadership, it might, you know, include that like in this topic, but could you tell me why do you think this is?
Certainly. Well, let's just look at the data first, at least the US data. is if you were a US company in the last 25 years, you had a 50% chance of making it 5 years. You had a 25% chance of making it 15 and about a 16% chance of making it 25. So the longer you're in business, the less likely you are to stay in business, which to me doesn't make any sense because of you think if you do something longer, you get better at it.
But
I'll answer this. I don't really know the answer, Natsuni, but I have my theories. I think it's really hard to prove a negative, you know, but I think what happens is that tiny errors compound. Right. This is sort of chaos theory or the butterfly effect. You know, the butterfly flaps its wings and something happens. I think so. Something happens, and we do a bunch of stuff wrong, for the most part. And some of those things are pretty important, like hiring and meetings and strategy and execution. And we do a whole bunch of stuff that not really that well. And at the beginning, it's okay because it's just a few of us or not a lot of us, and we have the time and energy to do it. So I think many folks survive, and I'll get to the answer to your question in a second, through force of will, effort, luck, and timing. But those things don't scale. So as you get bigger and bigger and bigger, it just becomes harder. It's sort of like if you're pulling something and they just keep adding more weight to it, it just becomes harder and you get more employees and more things and more decisions. And so all of these errors that you make, I think, start to compound on you. And eventually you either die or what's really more unfortunate, because you know death is at least has some finality to it and some conclusion. But most companies that don't struggle, and they're just, I mean, the stress of having to, you know, get the next deal and get meet payroll is just too much. So I think that's the main reason. And I'll pre-answer your next question, which is, so why do folks thrive? And I think that's because those ones that thrive have this longer view, and they understand that as a leader, you have sort of, if you're a leader and you're really definitively called a leader, there's one thing that all leaders have in common, and that is they have followers. You can't be a leader if you don't have people following you. And following someone is a voluntary act. You have to give yourself to someone to follow them. So they have to believe in something that you believe in, or believe in you in some way in order for them to say, yes, you know, I think Natsuni is awesome and her vision is great. And I just want to help her make that happen. I don't want to be in charge, you know, and leading, but I want to make it happen. I want to be one of those people. So most of us have some sort of vision. I'm sure when you started doing all this stuff, that's when you said, you know, this is what I want to do. And maybe you have a picture of it. Like when all of this is done and complete, this is what it looks like. That's your vision. Now, a lot of leaders have that, but they don't tell anyone. Or they think they're telling them and they're not. So what I do is I make all my leaders write it down. I say, you have a vision? Great, write it down. It's not a sentence, it's pages. It should be, I like to say, you should describe it in such a way that when we get there, you recognize it. So I should explain it as if we're already there. So when we get there, you'll know. And then you can say, great, I love that vision. I want to do that with you. I want to be part of what you do. I want to make it happen. Or you know what? I thought we were doing something else. And I think I'm going to leave. And that's good too. Because you don't want people who don't believe what you believe, they'll slow everything down. So I think the ones that do that, you know, they have this compelling vision, and then they know how to execute on it, right? Then they're really good at making it happen. So they sort of put that vision, that strategy, that execution together. And then lastly, that they understand that in order to make sure that this thing happens, we need money, we need cash, because growth costs money. And generally you have to pay in front of growing. When Alan Mulally took over Ford in 2006, they were losing $17 billion that year. $17 billion they lost, and they did it.
That's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money. There's some countries that don't have $17 billion. They lost it. But when he came about, he said, here's what I want to do. And he had four things he wanted to do. He said, we are one team. You know, it's about the people. It's about the team, right? Making it happen and taking care of them, et cetera. Those stakeholders that I talked about earlier. And then he said, we want to make sure that we have the right product mix that our customers want and value. And that's about strategy. That's about understanding your customer and delivering what they want. And we said, we have to operate profitably at the model mix, which is execution. And lastly, he says, we have to fund this thing. And he went out and he borrowed $23 billion to pay for it, because he said, if we're going to do this thing, and he had a plan, it's going to cost this much money. And he went up to people and said, here's my plan, here's my vision. It's going to take a while. Mm-hmm. But when he was done, he left in 2014. And so in the middle of 2008, right, he took over before 2008, went through 2008, and left in 2014. He was the only CEO that didn't take any money from the federal government. He actually took a little bit. He paid it back before the big loans. Mm-hmm. And then when in 2015, the year after he left, Ford, for the first time since they started, became the number one car company in the world again. So, but it was 2006. It was 8 years. It took a long time, mm-hmm. but it happened. So I love these stories because it gives you the understanding that take it easy, right? Just make sure that you're making good decisions, smart decisions, mm-hmm. And you're thinking about these things, right? And I think it's team, run your business as a system, and then have that cash as your metric. Those are the three main things that help you get there to thrive.
Interesting. So it sounds a lot like, it's interesting how you're describing there's a difference between I guess long-term strategy, which predicate more on like a patient mindset, like more intangible thing, versus you also have to care for the cash, which lays into more like strategy, like practicality in a daily basis. And this is something that I just like to describe also that is applicable in life as well. But so that actually kind of led me to my next question, which is, what is the gap between science and business?
Sure. So let me touch on one thing, because I think since you're in Japan, right?
Yeah.
That's funny. So I think Japan as a country is an excellent example of how to do this well. Mm-hmm. And I know that there are two companies that I know of that have a little understanding of, but there are many companies in Japan that have been around for hundreds and hundreds of years. I read about one that makes mochi, and they're in Kyoto or somewhere near Kyoto, and they've been around for over 1,000 years. The family is on its whatever generation, and they make mochi. That's all they do, and that's all they make, and they've been there forever, and it's a family-run business, but they are patient, and they take their time. They understand that they need the money, and they've obviously survived wars and all sorts of things, and they're still in business. There's another company that just got sold, I think, in about 5 or 6 years ago, that made pagodas. I can't remember the name of it. And they were 900 and something years old, and all they did was make pagodas. But they were the go-to for pagodas. So I just wanted to celebrate that I think that there are examples around the world of how to do this. But we Americans think we know everything and we're better than everybody. And we don't pay attention to anything. So which is kind of ridiculous. But anyway, so the reason that I think people don't follow the science and they go with we go with intuition and conventional wisdom, right? Mm-hmm. We hear the same things. I'm on LinkedIn a lot, and I read a number of things. And I got to tell you, a lot of the stuff I read on LinkedIn is just wrong. People say, oh, you got to do this, you got to do that. And I say, no, you don't. That's not what the research says. That's not how things work. So my best example is feedback, right? There are so many people out there that say, oh, I'm going to teach you how to give the right kind of feedback, right? You need to care deeply and do all these things. And the research says, no, you should try to avoid giving feedback. The goal is to get your employees and your team members, your family members, your kids, whatever, to grow and improve and get better. Feedback is one tool of very many, and it should be the last tool that you use. But the conventional wisdom is we must tell them what they did wrong so they can get better. And you don't. And actually, there's a great method I love by this guy, Jeff Hunter, which says, if you're working with someone and they're doing something that you don't think is meeting the standard, you should go to them and say, hey, I just want to chat with you about what we talked about, what you did. And do you remember the standard on how to do this? And then you review the standard, right? These are the things that we say are the best things we want to do, the optimum way of doing it. How do you think it went? Do we meet the standard on this? And if they're not sociopaths or whatever, they're going to say, oh no, we didn't, right? And tell me where. What do you think we didn't meet it? Okay, great. And they'll say this, this, and this. Okay, so what do you think we would need to happen next time in order to get us either at or closer to the standard? And the person would say, I think next time I would do this or this or this. Great. And that may be perfect. Yeah. That may be enough. I didn't give them any feedback at all in that conversation. None whatsoever. Right? But most people say, I need to tell you, Alberto, that when you, I love the story. When you say and ah and what all the time, you sound stupid. Which is just terrible, because now, even though I'm kidding, your brain is probably saying, screw you, Bill. You know, that's we don't right. like that. We don't like to be told that we don't know what we're doing. And the brain doesn't like that. It rejects that information. So that's, I think, why people, we think we know what we're doing and we don't understand some first principles. And I love to study first principles, right? Elon Musk is a first principles guy. If you understand first principles, you can get to the root of the problem and do a much better job and do things that others thought were impossible. People thought there's no way you're going to be able to put a rocket in the air and then jettison its cargo and then bring it back down and land it. And it was super hard, but he learned about it and he said, you know what? This is not a physics problem. This can be done. It's a super hard problem, but he finally did it. Why? Because his vision is, I want to go to Mars. And the only way you can go to Mars is you need to land there with a rocket and take off to come back. So he's working through the problem, right? He's like, okay, first I got to figure out how to do that. And now I have to make a lot more money because then it's going to cost a lot of money to go to Mars. And so he's got this plan and people have invested in him. It's 25 year plan. So I think that's why that people don't understand the science. They don't say there's a lot of science around business. We know how to run a business really well. We've proven it. You know, companies in Japan have proven it, but we just ignore it because it doesn't make sense to us because the conventional wisdom says, you know, you have to have revenue. You have to do this. You know, you have to grow fast. You have to beat the competition. Mm. Who said?
Yeah, I guess here the point is oftentimes we ignore human psychology when it comes to things, right? When it comes to leadership, when it comes to managing a business, we care about outcome, we care about results, but we ignore the fact that results are the product of human beings putting in the work. And we just totally skip that part of the, you know, equation and we just jump right to the end of it, which is the outcome. And that creates this kind of like, in my opinion, misalignment between, you know, interests and people within an organization. I very much agree with you. I guess that, you know, my philosophy is encouragement works, but punishment doesn't. Going back to your point, right? If you tell somebody how to do something, unless they realize that themselves, it's going to be hard that they are going to, you know, buy into your, explanation or whatever, you know, you got to encourage them. So that's a very good point.
That is a very good point. So let's move to my next question, which is, in running the business, I think we've been kind of touching on this very specific topic, but what would you say are the few things that actually matter, like truly matter?
Yeah, so I say I work in threes. I love the threes, I guess. So what I found is that there are three main reasons why most businesses struggle. One is that they ignore the gap between science and what we know about the science of business and what we actually do. Mm-hmm. And that they don't understand that if you're gonna run a business or you're gonna run your life, that few things truly matter in business or in life, mm-hmm. but those that do matter tremendously. Mm-hmm. And you guys seem, maybe you're a little young, but, and if you have children, you understand this immensely because your life was going along and things were important. And all of a sudden you had a child. Mm-hmm. And then the next day, a number of things that you thought were really important no longer were. And usually it's about yourself, right? It's about this child and your job is to take care of this. And you want it to be a wonderful human being that contributes to the world, mm-hmm. you know, generally. So you spend a lot of time and energy trying to do that. And a lot of the other stuff that you used to do, you don't do anymore. I didn't see as many friends anymore. And, you know, I didn't exercise as much and, you know, whatever. So that's really important. And you have to understand about a business. What are the few things that truly matter to your team and your stakeholders? And you got to really focus on those things, make them happen. And then lastly, again, mostly in the West, we're not patient. I made it in a cute little phrase, which is called a deduction before production. Which basically means we want to just do, right? I talk to a lot of founders and they say, you know, so I'm a fan of Steve Blank in customer development in terms of startup founders. I'm also, I ascribe to the jobs to be done theory, which basically says, and for the most part, if you want to start a company, don't do anything first. Try to figure out if there's a market, right? Go talk to people and ask them questions. Like you're a reporter, right? You're a journalist. So you have, as if you have no stake in the outcome. And you'll find that when you do this, you'll learn things from people. And I've done hundreds and hundreds of these interviews. So I'm very familiar with the process. Mm-hmm. Customers never really buy the things that, for the reasons you think, I have found, and I've learned this, is that we think we know why people buy our products. Mm-hmm. But then when you ask them, you realize that people don't really care what you make. They care what you make does for them. And that's what they care about, right? They're trying to make their lives better. They're trying to have some sort of progress in their life. And your job is to help them do that as a provider. Mm. I learned this once. I won't tell the long, I'll tell the short version of the story. So I started a company. I was a data backup company. It was 2005. And I just started my first day, first week. And I had this process that I do when I go, which is I want to understand why. I want to say, why do our customers buy from us? And a lot of times I come in and they're already customers, even though it's a startup. I'm generally the scale up guy. I'm not the founder. So I went out, I did some interviews with customers. I said, tell me your best customers and I want to talk to them. And I had a bunch of questions, but mostly I was trying to understand why. And I had one key question I was asking, which is, what is the most valuable thing that you got from using our product? And I used thing on purpose because I didn't want to lead them into feature, benefit, whatever. I just want to be very vague and to hear what they say. And so for those of you who don't know, in before 2000-ish, if you wanted to back up your data as a company, you had to put it on a tape reel or a video or VHS or something. It was on tape, which is a degenerative media. It would fail. And it was a horrible process, right? You as the owner had to do it, or you had someone do it, and you had to do it every day, and you had to store it, and you had to make sure that you kept track of it. It was this whole process you had to go through, which you guys are thinking, because you're pretty young, you're like, well, that sounds insane. Why don't you just put it up to the cloud and you can get it whenever you want, right? But the cloud wasn't really a thing yet. So I went out and talked to these folks, but before I did, I asked the existing folks, and this company had been around for years and years before I got there. And they were struggling. And I asked them, why do you think our customers buy from us? And they said, oh, it's because it's basically an insurance purchase, which they meant by, you know, if they lose their data, they're willing to pay a little bit of money every month to get it back, to feel like they have that sort of peace of mind. And I said, well, that's a pretty good answer, because most people, when I ask them that, say, and I've asked this to hundreds and hundreds of CEOs, why do you think customers buy from you? And mostly they say, and I'll give the general broad answer, which is because we are awesome. That's their answer. Because we're really good at what we do. And I keep saying, no, it's not why they buy from you.
Yeah.
They don't really care how awesome you are. So I went out and talked to these people, and I talked to 17 people. And I think it was 12 or so said the exact same words to me when I asked that question. Exact same words. And I didn't lead them in any way. They said, set it and forget it. Right?
Yeah.
So we were selling insurance. They were buying time. So I told my team, I said, whenever you talk to a prospect, you must say these five words. Our best customers are super busy, small to medium business owners. And they say, you know, if you're telling me now, instead of doing all this crap with all I had to do with tape, I can hit a few buttons on the web and I just hit go and I never have to think about it ever again. Mm. It's like, yes, that's true. How much does that cost? I want some of that. Mm. And we grew every month, beat the last month, every quarter, beat the last quarter. And 18 months later, Iron Mountain, who's a big storage company, at least here in the US, I think they're worldwide, bought us for 10 times revenue.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah, which is pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, that's like, yeah, that's pretty like 100 good. Times EBITDA or something, or maybe like 50 times EBITDA, right? Now, it wasn't just that one thing. There was lots of other stuff, a lot of momentum going on, and we did a bunch of other stuff, but we proved it. And that's what, you know, that's what I think, customers, you have to do, you have to be patient. You have to start your company understanding, is there a problem worth solving? And do I understand it well enough to be able to start to work? Most founders just want to start doing something. They want to make something, they want to go out and then they want to sell it. And people don't like that, right? And that's why you struggle. So that's why I think that happens.
So I have two questions before I let you go.
Yeah.
First one is, so that whole story made me really curious, like, what is the process of company confirming or learning or listening to potential customers? Like, let's talk about the process a little bit. And then the next one is actually going back to the leadership question. Should we just talk about the first one first? No?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
So I'll tell another story. So I'm a big fan of jobs to be done. Do either of you familiar with the jobs to be done theory?
No.
Which is really funny because it's like 30 years old. It's been around forever. But most people don't know what it is. And again, that's the jobs to be done theory is science. It's been proven at least 3,000 times by the same guy.
Wow.
Who's been using it for 30 years. Mm-hmm. And other people do it as well. But just one guy alone who was the originator of it has been using it. And this is the most famous story about it, which is about milkshakes. And the people who started this theory in the 80s and 90s, mm-hmm. They have a consulting company. And their consulting company was asked by what is very likely a McDonald's franchise owner to say, look, we need help because we want to sell more milkshakes. And they first came in and they said, what did you do to get there? And they said, oh, we did. We talked to our customers and we asked them, what would it take for you to buy more milkshakes? Mm-hmm. And he said, well, what did they tell you? And he replied, well, they said, you know, we need different flavors and we need different consistencies and a bunch of other stuff. And he said, so what did you do? Well, we did everything they said. What happened to sales? Nothing. Not a thing. Sales did not change. Mm-hmm. So he said, okay, great. Good to know. So he came in the next day with his team and he just observed. He said, we're just going to watch. And so they watched all day mm-hmm. and they found out that 40% or so of all the milkshakes purchased during the day mm-hmm. were purchased before 8 a.m. Mm-hmm. And the second largest number was somewhere in the middle of the afternoon, 3 to 5 p.m. Mm-hmm. And so they got this information and they went back out the next day and they started to talk to the people and they said, what did you hire the milkshake to do for you? What job are you asking the milkshake to perform for you? Right? Really weird question, but that's basically what we do. We hire.
That's interesting. Theory, yeah.
Jobs to be done is about people hire products and services and then fire them when something else comes along or it doesn't. We don't buy anything. We hire stuff and then we fire it. So what he found in the morning was interesting. He said it was pretty consistent that they were commuters and they had a really long commute. It was pretty boring. Mm-hmm. They weren't hungry yet, but they knew they'd be hungry and they want to make it through to lunch. And so having a milkshake was safe, right? So it was something that could make them sort of fill them up. It passed the time a little bit for them. It was obviously tasty because it's basically sugar. Mm-hmm. And then he said, well, what other kind of things did you hire as well? And they said, well, one guy, you know, people said, well, we hired a bagel and cream cheese, you know, but that was messy and it was kind of dangerous because, you know, I had to smear the stuff and the crumbs got everywhere. And then the cream cheese got on my fingers and that got on the steering wheel. So I fired that, you know, some people said I hired a banana, but that didn't fill me up. And that was, you know, the feeling of the stuff on the banana peel was gross. And someone said, well, I hired a Snickers bar, but I felt guilty. So I didn't want to do it anymore. And you know, of course you're thinking, but you're drinking a milkshake. The same thing. But again, we're irrational. And the guy rationalized, well, it's a milkshake. So it must be, it's milk, cut the word milk. So that was interesting. And then in the afternoon, they found out that it was mostly dad and dad was with the kids and dad wanted to be the cool dad because the kids would say, hey, can we get a milkshake? And he'd say, well, you know, we can, but you know, don't tell mom. So what they did in the morning was that they didn't change the product at all. They changed the way they delivered it. Because one of the things that people said was, hey, you know, sometimes in the morning, and I don't know, you probably have really great coffee places. You're in Italy, of course, you have great coffee places. But if you want to drive through, sometimes in the morning, at least pre-COVID, the line is really long, right? You have to sit and wait 10 or 15, 20 minutes to get your coffee.
Right.
Of course, because you don't want to get out of your car and go in, right? That's crazy.
Right.
So they said, great, here's what we're going to do. We're going to set up a section on the counter. We're going to put all the milkshakes in it and we're doing a card swipe. This was a long time ago. So card swipe was a big deal. Now it's nothing, right? And all you have to do is get out of your car, quickly run in, don't have to talk to anybody, grab your milkshake, do your card swipe and go. And guess what happened to sales? They went up, right? Now in the afternoon, same product, completely different solution. Since it was the kid, they changed the packaging because the container for kids wasn't good, even for adults, right? Because those cups get a little wet and they get squishy and you can spill the stuff or squeeze it too hard. So they made it more like a sippy cup. Mm-hmm. And then they made it smaller so dad didn't feel as guilty. And they made the straw bigger because kids had a harder time sucking out the thing. And guess what happened in the afternoon? Sales went up. So same product, two different customers hiring it for completely different reasons, but they understood what they were trying to do. Mm-hmm. And they went to where the customer wanted them to go, mm-hmm. and the customer rewarded them with more sales. Mm-hmm. That's why, that's what you have to do. You have to understand, you have to get inside their head. And by the way, we don't know as consumers what we really want, mm-hmm. but we know what we hate. We know what we're trying to accomplish, and we know what our struggles are. Mm-hmm. And that's what we need to describe. And it's our job as the provider, mm-hmm. to take that information and say, well, how would we solve that problem? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, and there's a famous saying here in the US from Henry Ford, which he never said, but it's a great saying, which he said, if I asked my customers what they wanted, I would have just built faster horses. Mm. And not, I never would have built cars, right? Mm. But what I understood was what they were trying to accomplish. I understood what they were trying to do. And so he found that, his job was to try to make the car inexpensive so more people could buy it. Mm. And that was one of the things they said. At that time, there were cars around Mercedes that had been making cars for years, but they were so expensive. Only the uber wealthy, like, mm. Jeff Bezos and, name your really, Warren Buffett kind of guy,
right.
Could afford them. He wanted to make it so everyone could afford them, because that was one of the barriers to people buying cars. Mm-hmm. So
I see. So I know that we don't have much time, so I'm just
going to
squeeze in real quick another question, actually, following up to that. Like, what are the methods for businesses to communicate with these companies to gain these insights, like directly talking to them?
Yeah, so there's, if you're a startup or any company, there's something called customer development or customer discovery, and that's sort of what it's called. And that's the method. There's actually a method of how you do it. There's steps that you take and assumptions that are made, and I've run people through this process. But basically, it's a mindset more than anything, is you have to approach the problem as if you don't care about the outcome. Because as soon as we as consumers think you're trying to sell us something, mm-hmm. we will change our answers. There's something in physics called the Heisenberg principle, which says that just the act of observing the experiment changes the experiment's outcome. And that's the same thing here. You have to try to not change the outcome by being eager. Even if you lean forward or you get a little excited, people will say, oh, Bill wants me to answer it in a way that make him feel good. And we're, as human beings, we generally want to be nice to other people, but you don't want that. You want them to give you the honest truth. You want them to complain. I like to say that people are really love doing two things. We love to complain and we love to tell people our problems.
Right.
And that's gold for someone who wants to make something. Because if someone tells you their problems, then you can be creative and innovative and figure out ways to solve it.
Yeah, that is so true. Mm-hmm.
So that's more than any, there are tons of different methods, jobs to be done as a method and all that kind of stuff, but it's really the mindset. If you enter it as if you're a journalist, right? You're just trying to find out the who, what, when, why, how mm-hmm. stuff, and then you'll answer better questions. The last thing I'll say with this is, if you go into it, don't worry about all the questions. A lot of the founders I work with say, I need my list of questions that I have to ask them. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's good for this, right? This is an interview. You're trying to walk somebody through something. Mm-hmm. But for a consumer, you don't want that. You want to write down one or two things that you want to learn. And you're trying to get to those learnings. And then guess what happens? The questions just come. You'll probably have one or two starter questions. But then they'll start to say something and you'll go down that road and you'll say, tell me more about that. And why did you do that? And how did you deal with it? And did that work? And you just keep going until the thread ends. And then you go back to your learnings and start again. Most people don't do that. They say, I have seven questions I want to ask you and this and this and this and this.
Yeah,
you have to have a conversation. Mm. So that's the method, so to speak, that generally works well. I'll give you one thing, which is, there's a great book which just came out. So the guy I was talking about, Bob Mesta, about the jobs to be done, he's been doing it for 30 years. And I've been waiting for him to write a book that shows people how to do it, because it's really hard to do. And he finally wrote it. It's only been out for a few months. It's called Demand Side Sales 101. And he walks through the process. He has tons of examples. Mm. So I would say, pick that up. If you're interested, pick up that book and read it and give it a go.
Well, thank you very much for hearing that. That's amazing. So, Bill, are you okay with the time?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So I have just one more question. Just real quick.
Fire away.
Okay. So, all that being said, we still come back to the original point, which is to say all these strategies are going to be helpful if you have the right mindset as a business, right? So that being said, I wanted to talk about what does it mean to create a culture of psychological safety as a leader? And how is it important to organization?
Yeah, so there are a number of things that come together, and this is, again, back to science. I'm a neuroscience geek. I've been studying neuroscience for about 15 years, and I have a certificate from the Neuro Leadership Institute on all that kind of stuff. And what generally is being understood right now is that so let's define psychological safety, because it is a term. It was a term that was invented by Amy Edmondson. She's written a number of books. She's a Harvard Business School professor and researcher. And it basically says that psychological safety is when you are in a workplace setting, or any setting, where you don't feel like if you make a mistake, you admit an error, you do something wrong, you throw out a crazy idea, that you won't have scorn or ridicule or retribution. So you feel psychologically safe, right? You're not put into sort of some threat mode. You come up with an idea, Alberto, and I'll say, great, that's a really stupid idea. Mm. That's not safe. Because if I do that over and over again, you're just going to stop giving the ideas.
All right. You self-protect yourself. Yeah.
Yeah, of course, right? Especially if your boss is saying that. And so that's what psychological safety is. So I think one of the main tenets of making sure that you have psychological safety is for the leader to exhibit that, to show that they are a human being. And that they say, I read in my book, I say that if you want to really be a really good leader and create psychological safety, you have to get really comfortable with three phrases. I don't know, I'm sorry, and I need help. Hmm. And if you do that over and over again and you accept it, and you're sincere about it, people will realize, oh, well, this is safe. I can do those things. You know, my boss is human. He or she makes mistakes all the time. Mm-hmm. That's okay. You'll create this environment. And I think one of the things that really helps is this thing called growth mindset, which is something Carol Dweck has written about in his research for years. And for those of you who don't know what it is, I definitely recommend reading a little bit about it. But to me, it's all around one word, which is yet. I don't know that yet. I can't do that yet, but I know I can. Some people will be able to learn it faster. Some people will take a long time. Some people will not learn it because it's not interesting to them. But almost anything out there, except some really, really hard problems, almost anyone can do. And that's been proven over and over again with skill building and, et cetera. So if you really believe that growth mindset that you don't know that, and you believe it in yourself, you'll also believe it in others. And then you'll be more supportive of them and compassionate for them. And then you'll create this environment of safety around the fact that you're supporting them. You focus on positive things. As you said, Alberto, let's focus on the positive, not the negative. That creates this environment of psychological safety. And when you create that environment, it's amazing what people will do to help you make your vision a reality.
Yeah. That is great. Yeah, that is really great.
Yeah, I'm having goosebumps. Like, that's super.
Oh, cool.
So, Bill, thank you very much for your time today. Thank you very much for coming to the show. Before I let you go, let's please tell my listeners where people can find you.
Sure. So everything you'd find about me is on my website, which is catalystgrowthadvisors.com. My phone number is there. My email is there. I write twice a month a blog post, really short, 1 to 2 page blog post, 1 to 2 minute blog post. They're almost always action oriented. I'm a very pragmatic guy. I want you to know stuff, but also be able to do something with it. I have exercises. My book is on there. For my book, I'm more about the message than the money. Mm-hmm. So you can actually download my book for free from my website as a PDF, or you can go to Amazon or Audible and get it there.
Amazing. Thank you very much. And I'll make sure those links are going to be included in the show notes. So
thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Bill. And I hope you have a good day.
You guys go to bed.
Yeah, thank you.